Good morning. My name is Ilya Shapiro. I'm the director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. And this is the third in our series on coronavirus and the Constitution. 3 months into the pandemic, things are opening back up in fits and starts with legal challenges about lingering shutdowns that may no longer be justified, as well as other shutdowns that were always on dubious legal grounds. We're still talking about the state's police power to govern for public health and safety. And this is a power that's not unlimited, like any power, but governors and mayors do have broad discretion, assuming they have a good enough justification for putting in their restrictions and regulations. 3 months ago, these officials were acting on the best epidemiological data. The idea is that we were all potentially fist swingers. You know, my freedom ends at the point of your nose. Well, if asymptomatic people could transmit a deadly virus, then shelter-in-place orders and the like could be justified. Some state actors have gone beyond their state constitutional limits. A few weeks ago, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin found that state's health authorities violated the separation of powers, went against Wisconsin administrative law. There's also been lower court rulings in Oregon, Ohio, and Illinois about different aspects of those states' shutdown orders in whole or in part. I think that's gratifying that we still have checks and balances, that we there's no pandemic exception to the Constitution, as the Supreme Court of Texas put in a concurrence a few weeks ago. And this all goes to Jacobson versus Massachusetts, a now famous Supreme Court case from 1905, allowing mandatory vaccination. Although Jacobson still recognized that there are limits. Let me quote from that. If health regulations went beyond the necessity of the case and under the guise of exerting a police power violated the rights secured by the Constitution, the court would be bound to hold such laws invalid. And so even beyond kind of broad-based challenges to lockdown orders, some specific measures have gone too far. Restrictions on drive-in churches when drive-in liquor stores across the street are open. Tennis courts roping off store aisles that have so-called non-essential goods rather than simply restricting the number of people per square foot of a store, that sort of thing. A woman in Dallas who was jailed for opening her hair salon, that was ultimately reversed. An Ohio court ruled stopping the closure of gyms because it wasn't the proper authorities. They weren't exercising that kind of power. The attorney general last month sent a letter saying that the federal government would be enforcing people's civil rights. And it's done so in several occasions, particularly with regard to religious liberty. And the Supreme Court, speaking of religious liberty, just last week issued a 5-4 decision not stopping a California a restriction on in-person church gatherings, although that might need to be reevaluated now that California has permitted the demonstrations and protests. And so if churches are similarly situated to those kind of secular gatherings, maybe the law looks different. Even if the orders all go away tomorrow, though, people won't feel safe right away, although public opinion is changing rapidly on all of that and shows that private action is just as or more important than public law. Now that we flatten the curve, preventing hospitals from being overwhelmed, indeed, healthcare workers have been laid off, people want to resume their lives and recoup as much as they can. Conventional wisdom is that we could get things moving quicker if we had broader testing programs and more ambitious contact tracing. But can the government, any level, force you to get tested before you go to certain places or participate in certain activities? Can it make you wear a mask whenever you go outside? Can businesses require temperature testing at the door? Can the government work with technology companies and force you to download apps to track your phone and make sure you're following distancing guidelines? Whether digital or analog, what kinds of powers can contact tracers have, and how does all this relate to the Fourth Amendment? For all of these issues, I'm going to turn to my colleague Matthew Feeney, the director of Cato's Project in Emergency Technologies, and federal FTC commissioner Christine Wilson, who had a very interesting May 13th op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Coronavirus Demands a Privacy Law. Turn it over to Matthew first. Matthew seems to be muted.
I'm here now. Sorry about that. Yes.
There we go.
I hope you, there we go. So thank you. Thank you, Ilya. And I'd like to start by pointing out that I come at this through a technology and civil liberties perspective. I treat this issue as one that implicates, obviously, the Fourth Amendment, which protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures, as well as new and emerging technologies. And we're in a situation now where it looks to many people as if increased surveillance would actually be very useful. We're in a situation now where there's an ongoing pandemic, and you can reliably tell a lot about the spread of the pandemic depending on where people have been, arguably. And the issue is that many people have talked about emerging technologies in the context of contact tracing, which is to find out more about where people have been and who they've spoken to. Many of the viewers will be familiar with the Fourth Amendment, which protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. And since 1967, the expectation of privacy test has really been the lodestar of this amendment. And when we're thinking about reasonable expectations, as well as some of the emerging technologies we've seen recently, there are two cases I'd like to discuss because I think they're relevant to the conversation that Ilya outlined. The first is US v. Jones, which concerned the use of a GPS tracker on a Jeep. Here, the law enforcement officials put a GPS tracker on a Jeep belonging to Antoine Jones, who they suspected of being a drug dealer. This was done without a valid warrant. And there, the court took a bit of a dodge by saying, well, this physical attachment onto the car actually implicated a trespass onto the vehicle and therefore is unconstitutional. It's a notable case because there was a five-justice so-called shadow majority where you had justices, the traditional liberals, as well as Alito, arguing basically, well, it can't just be this. You know, we have to think about reasonable expectations and tracking. The other is a case that came out a few years ago. This is Carpenter v. United States. There's many viewers will be familiar, I hope, that their phone is playing a constant game of Marco Polo with nearby cell towers. This case involved the government access to information gathered about Timothy Carpenter's whereabouts in order to secure a conviction for armed robbery. And what's interesting here is that the court did hold that the warrantless collection of these kind of records for about a week did violate the Fourth Amendment, but it's a very, very narrow holding, with the Chief Justice noting that the opinion didn't touch other surveillance technologies. And this brings us to the ongoing conversation about the kind of technologies we're concerned about. You've seen some people from Apple and Google talking about Bluetooth technology so that if you download a certain app, your phone will notify you if you've been within physical proximity of someone who has tested positive for COVID-19. The issue here is that because Carpenter's a narrow decision, we haven't had any ruling on this technology per se. What I will say is when it comes to government mandating of the downloading of apps onto phones, you potentially do implicate Jones here because it is potentially arguably a trespass onto your property. This and other issues were discussed by Professor Rosenstein from the University of Minnesota Law School, who I had a great article about not just how this is a potentially a trespass, but also raising the issue of the special needs doctrine, that under the Fourth Amendment, there is a special needs exception. Usually this is discussed in the context of drunk driving stops or searching student athletes. But we do know that, for example, Justice Kavanaugh does believe, for example, that the bulk NSA metadata collection was justified under special needs. And it's possible that you could have a pandemic special need. Ilya did mention that there so far isn't a pandemic exception to the Constitution, but that's the kind of question that I think courts will have to consider if it becomes mandatory, if there's government mandates for certain technologies to be installed or owned. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to Christine.
Before Christine starts, I should remind the viewers that you can ask us questions, whether on the website or through Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube using the hashtag Cato SCOTUS. Christine. You're muted now, Christine.
There There you go. And we were warned not to make
the,
that mistake.
The technical host shouldn't have reminded everybody that the technical host shouldn't have reminded everybody to mute themselves and then unmute. That caused more problems than it fixed.
So thank you, Ilya, for inviting me to participate in the program. And thank you, Matthew, for laying such a great foundation for my discussion. I come at this as a perspective of a lawyer who practices consumer privacy data security law. The Federal Trade Commission does have responsibility for consumer privacy and data security enforcement in the United States using its general authority. We do not yet have a comprehensive privacy law, a federal privacy law in this country. We do have some sector-specific privacy legislation, including health data, financial data, children's data, but lots of gaps are emerging as technologies evolve. And we also have a multiplying set of state and international regimes, which is creating a patchwork of laws. And so on a bipartisan basis, for many years, the FTC has called for federal privacy legislation that would create predictability and certainty for businesses, but would also provide consumers with transparency about how their data are collected, used, monetized, and shared. And the transparency would help create digital trust. People may be unwilling to adopt new technologies if they're not sure what's happening with their data. And in any event, people can make more informed choices about what products and services to use if they understand the implications for their data. Now, the coronavirus, as it began to spread around the world, drove a new aspect of these discussions and I believe underscored the need for a federal privacy law. As efforts to engage in contact tracing and containment of the virus began to multiply, we saw mandatory apps deployed around the world. We also saw mechanisms formerly used for prisoners applied to those exposed with COVID-19. So for example, wrist trackers, mandatory wrist trackers. And this of course raises concerns, particularly because we're talking about sensitive health data, sensitive location data, and privacy principles have a lot to say about these issues, including use limitations for data that is collected. If you're collecting it for purposes of containing the virus, it shouldn't be used for any other purpose. Data minimization, only collect the data that you actually need to implement the contact tracing and containment of the virus. But this issue is also important for Fourth Amendment reasons, and this is one of the things that I wanted to emphasize in my op-ed. Matthew described the reasonable expectation of privacy test. And when you understand the implications of that test, you begin to realize that the commercial data, that the data that's collected on the commercial side actually is intricately related to government action. It is, the reasonable expectation of privacy test really complicates the relationship between government action and commercial data collection. And so we're talking about heightened concerns here. And in fact, we have heard that recent initiatives to track protesters may be using contact tracing information, which brings yet another wrinkle to this story. Last weekend, Minnesota's public safety commissioner used the phrase contact tracing to describe law enforcement efforts in connection with the murder of, with the protests that were taking place in connection with the murder of George Floyd. And the statement, it seems to have triggered widespread social media claims that contact tracing apps are being used by law enforcement agencies to track protesters for non-public health purposes. And some of the social media discussions reference the technology that Apple and Google have worked on that Matthew described for us. Interestingly, Travis LeBlanc, who is a Democrat on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board here in the United States, sent a letter to Acting Secretary Chad Wolf on Monday to the Department of Homeland Security. He said, the pandemic is not a hall pass to disregard the privacy and civil liberties of the traveling public. And I concur heartily in what Travis said. So the point of my op-ed even before the protests over the murder of George Floyd raised new issues, was to say, we need federal privacy legislation that can help apply some of the principles, the very familiar principles that we talk about in the privacy arena, to the collection of health data, location data. And with these established legal boundaries, companies would be better equipped to determine when the government is asking them to cross the line for the public good and whether they should require a subpoena or inform customers before turning over the data.
Great. Thank you for that, Christine. Matt, do you have anything in response to that, or did Christine's remarks trigger anything that you wanted to add?
Only briefly that I think the commissioner's comments really do highlight that the Supreme Court sets the floor, not the ceiling, that although we might be upset with a lot of Supreme Court precedent when it comes to things like the reasonable expectation of privacy test or the third party doctrine and a host of other issues, nonetheless, that doesn't prevent the legislature from improving upon that standard, which is obviously what Christine is calling for.
Yeah, I didn't know about...
There's a great book. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say there's a great book called Habeas Data that traces the line of Supreme Court cases that culminates with Jones and Carpenter, and makes the point in the last chapter that technology continues to outpace what the courts can handle, and that it really is up to Congress to step in and address this issue. And so I completely agree with Matthew that the Supreme Court is setting the floor, but we can do better.
The court also never wants to get ahead of technology, whether we're dealing with the Fourth Amendment or privacy area or antitrust or any legal areas where technology can disrupt, as it were, legal doctrine. And so in this area, what's interesting about the confluence of the Jones and Carpenter cases is that Fourth Amendment privacy protections often bring the left and the right together against the middle, or rather the principled versus the pragmatic, if you will, on the court. And so in these cases, you see Justices Sotomayor and Gorsuch perhaps forging the next doctrine, the reasonable expectation of privacy, that doctrine 50 years old in an analog world that in turn updated previous doctrine from the early days of the telephone. Maybe now in the digital age, whether you're focusing on people's strong protections for their personal effects, which can be all contained effectively on your phone. Think about your financial health records, family photos. So much is on that one little device, more than the police could get from 2 hours of ransacking your home, perhaps. Those kind of principles, the meaning of those things, along with Justice Sotomayor's concern for interpreting people's privacy in a modern age where police have different tools and what have you. And it could, people have been expecting, even as the court takes very small steps in the Fourth Amendment arena to update doctrine, people have been expecting kind of a supersession of the reasonable expectation test. But maybe this emergency type, unusual pandemic related situation will provide a case, contact tracing or otherwise, where that will happen. We have a question that maybe we should address at the outset, kind of the most obvious ones. Matthew, why don't you, comes in from Segalen Bossard, who asks, can states require their citizens to download a contact tracing app?
My understanding of the law is that no. It would, of course, they could under certain circumstances, I suppose. You can imagine a situation where there's, again, this gets us back to special needs, where there's actually potentially a carve-out. But as things stand, especially in this context, I don't see that being legally feasible. Something that we should keep in mind is something like the following, which is you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in illegal contraband or illegal behavior necessarily. So this gets us back to technologies or techniques like drug sniffing dogs. So I suppose it's hard to imagine how this would work. But if there was a technology that only notified the police when you broke some kind of lockdown order, then potentially you'd be in safer legal grounds. But at the moment, I don't see that being feasible.
And I'll remind people that you can ask your questions either on the Cato website, if you're viewing it there, or on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube with hashtag Cato SCOTUS. Christine, as you're looking at and proposing a federal privacy law, how do you delineate what's there for whether the FTC or another federal agency to do versus leaving things to the states?
So it's a great question that actually proved to be one of the two sticking points in getting federal privacy legislation across the finish line. The first sticking point has been preemption. And should there be preemption, including of California's new law, CCPA, which sets a very high bar for privacy. And I think that preemption is important because the internet doesn't stop at state boundaries, let alone national boundaries. I believe that the Federal Trade Commission should be given authority to enforce federal privacy legislation, and that the state AGs should also have authority to enforce that legislation as force multipliers for the Federal Trade Commission. But I think that state laws that set different levels of protection for consumers will just maintain this patchwork of laws that is going to lead to consumer confusion about what their rights are and what kinds of data are allowed to be collected in any given state. And then also chill innovation and investment in new technology by companies who are facing essentially a patchwork of laws and need to tailor their efforts to a lowest common denominator.
Just to be clear for the non-lawyers watching this, preemption means that sometimes the federal government can, through the supremacy clause in the Constitution, can trump state law that's to the contrary. You can preempt that law in the legalese. But of course, you always have to look at whether the federal government has the requisite powers. In this case, it would be to regulate interstate commerce with data traveling all over the place, as well as these civil liberties concerns. But you could have cooperative federalism in a sense, or rather state and federal regulations that both have to be satisfied when dealing with this sensitive data. Matthew, did you have something to add there?
No, I would only, actually something did just occur to me. So that you have seen that there have been states that have passed their own privacy law. So California being perhaps the most notable. And I think the experiences there should make us cautious about what's involved in federal privacy legislation, because part of what I worry about is not only privacy, but also speech and making sure there is an innovative entrepreneurial market for tech. And I do worry that if we're not careful, that Congress could end up passing some kind of federal privacy law that actually is anti-competitive, that only powerful market incumbents can comply.
Yeah, so Ilya, if I could take a moment.
Sure.
That's actually that's the experience that the EU saw with its privacy legislation, GDPR, and they saw an increase in the market shares of some of the largest incumbents for advertising like Google and Facebook, and they saw venture capital investing in smaller companies dry up because of this essentially this entrenchment of incumbents and the chilling of competition, given so much emphasis on privacy. The costs of compliance were incredibly high, and a lot of smaller companies either couldn't afford those costs or chose not to bear those costs. You also saw lots of US companies withdrawing from the EU market because of the cost of compliance. And so I completely agree with Matthew that we do need to take competition into account. We don't want a privacy law that chills innovation and stifles competition. At the same time, a privacy law could help boost trust in new technologies. Right now, consumers realize they have no transparency with respect to what data is being collected and how it's being shared and deployed. In fact, Matthew was talking about mandatory use of apps in response to a question about that. In fact, if it were voluntary, the Washington Post conducted a poll and found that basically more than half of Americans would be unwilling to download those apps because they don't trust that the tech companies are going to keep their identities private if they end up testing positive for COVID-19. And so that lack of digital trust leads to a lack of use of emerging technologies. And, you know, and that can lead to chilled innovation, decreased incentives to invest in innovation. But during the time of a pandemic, actually, the lack of confidence in tech companies and contact tracing could prove fatal. So there are very serious consequences of getting it right, but also of not doing anything.
Yeah, sure. Like with any regulation, you have to guard against the big established incumbent players always having more money to spend on compliance officers and lawyers that can crowd out their would-be entrepreneurial competitors. Matthew, I know that we've been talking in the last weeks offline about whether digital contact tracing is even effective. I mean, if you're in a fairly dense urban environment, and you get a ping that you're somewhere close to or have been somewhere close to someone who's infected, how useful is that? And conversely, would it give, is there a danger that thereby the authorities would just lock down, 1,000 people that are in a relatively small geographic area just because everyone's so close together without really giving any parsimony to the contact tracing?
That is a real concern. I think I hope that lawmakers and law enforcement officials are taking lessons from the current pandemic. I think it's fair to say that you can make a strong argument that this kind of contact tracing is highly effective at the beginning of the outbreak, where you have a handful of cases. However, where we are now, I think there are serious questions about how effective it would be. So, for example, as Ilya pointed out, the Bluetooth technology or that kind of technology that's been discussed in this context notifies you if you've been close to another telephone, which presumably is on a person who is tested positive. Now, if you're in a dense apartment building or if you're out on the street and a bus pulls up next to you and the person inside the bus has tested positive and you're outside the bus and you are negative, that's not exactly the kind of dangerous exposure that I think a lot of people who are designing these technologies are worried about, or health professionals are worried about. The fact is that you're going to put a lot of people into lockdown in many, many environments if that kind of tracing is what's used. And some could make the argument, of course, that, look, maybe it's better to be overly cautious, that we should lock down entire apartment buildings or maybe whole towns and cities, because in this kind of environment, everyone's going to be notified they've been in close contact. And that's then a question for local officials about how much of the economy they're willing to sacrifice for that kind of degree of health and public safety. But I think it's very important, and I'm glad Ilya highlighted this, it's very important that, as well as the constitutional issues and the legal issues, we should also have a discussion about the technology and whether it would even be effective at this point.
Here's a related question from Aaron Kremen. Is an additional app even needed? All phones are tracked now. I would assume that information is de-identified to some degree, but we know through the accuracy of online advertising that you don't have to actually know who I am in order to know who I am.
Mm-hmm. This gets to a doctrine that we haven't discussed, which piggybacks off reasonable expectation, which is the so-called third-party doctrine. This idea being that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in information you, quote, volunteer to third parties, such as your telephone company or your internet service provider. And Congress has improved upon this flaw, but nonetheless, it still remains the case that you don't have the degree of privacy in a lot of information you give to internet companies that you would of pieces of property you have in your home, for example. So the question is, correct, that there is a lot of information out there already about where phones are located. But that was the kind of data that was at issue in Carpenter, for example. And there, I think if the court was to consider other kind of tracking technologies, they would likely come to a similar conclusion in Carpenter, which is, well, for this particular kind of tracing as used by governments, that's important. You know, the Fourth Amendment protects against government action. As far as the government's concerned, actually, this would probably run awry of the Fourth Amendment's protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. But when it comes to whether Google could just volunteer all this information to the FBI or to the Department of Justice or to Health and Human Services, that's more in Christine's wheelhouse, I suppose. But I would say that, at least from a law enforcement perspective, in the wake of Carpenter, you hope that they'd be somewhat hesitant to try and engage in that sort of snooping.
Christine, do you have anything on that?
So I would say that goes to the digital trust issue. We have seen Apple respond vehemently when the government tries to collect information from it with respect to potential crimes that have been committed. And it is an ongoing question that companies are grappling with. When and under what circumstances do they need to turn information over to the government? And we saw in Carpenter one answer to one narrow question. We've also seen with respect to contact tracing and with respect to other technologies deployed, these questions are arising, and I think federal privacy legislation could have provided some guardrails here. But for example, we saw Facebook turning over information about where people were at various times so that the efficacy of quarantine and stay-at-home orders could be traced, and supposedly all of that information was de-identified. We see Facebook deploying surveys across the country to collect information about symptoms and giving that information to researchers. And so Facebook has said, well, people consented to sharing this information because, you know, we have a privacy policy and people are supposed to read it and they're supposed to consent before they can use our services. And the fact is, no one gave consent to have their information used for purposes of contact tracing in a pandemic. No one had a pandemic in mind when they opened a Facebook account and gave consent. And I'm using Facebook as an example and maybe even as sort of a proxy for many other tech companies. But these are the kinds of questions that we do need to grapple with. When information is collected by a Facebook or a Google or any other tech company for a certain limited purpose of providing a service, is it then okay for them to use the data for a completely different and unanticipated purpose? And so federal privacy legislation would presumably provide some guidance about purpose limitations. And so there are lots of questions that are emerging. And frankly, we have more questions than answers. And it's one of the reasons I put in the op-ed, it would have been really great to have federal privacy legislation in place to at least provide some guardrails to help us grapple with some of these issues during the pandemic and now during nationwide protests and national unrest.
Here's a related question.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that Christine's last comment reminded me of the case Jones, which we've discussed before, where Justice Sotomayor in her concurrence actually put her finger on exactly this concern about what kind of consent there is when it comes to these technologies. And she asked, quote, "You know, I would ask whether people reasonably expect that their movements will be recorded and aggregated in a manner that enables the government to ascertain more or less at will their political and religious beliefs, sexual habits, and so on." And I think this exact question that we're trying to grapple with at the moment raises those issues, which is, well, because you click on the terms and agreements when you sign up for a Facebook account or Gmail, does that really mean that you're consenting to all the kinds of behaviors that are going on behind the scenes, what Facebook and Google are doing with that data? And that's a difficult question for, I think, lawmakers to grapple with, because on the one hand, these companies have to be careful with their terms of service. But on the other hand, no one's ever going to read through the dozens and dozens of pages necessary. So squaring that hole is going to be difficult.
There's a related question from Segalen Brossard. Again, good second question. Apple and Google defined some privacy standards that the app developers have to comply with to be able to use their technology. I think this is probably more directed to Christine. Do you see this as a restriction of the government's sovereignty, or I suppose an attack on, I don't know, FTC jurisdiction or something, or rather as a welcome initiative to protect privacy and How would your proposed federal law, I'm adding this part, how would your proposed federal law affect this question?
Great question. So the Federal Trade Commission over the course of many years has set out general principles with respect to consumer privacy. One of those is accountability for companies. And in lieu of federal privacy legislation that puts limits on the kinds of information that can be collected or the kinds of uses to which information can be put, the Federal Trade Commission has urged companies to abide by many of these principles. So data minimization, only collect the information that you need for the purpose that you're using it for, so that, among other things, if you're hacked, that information is more limited in scope and can perhaps do less harm if it's exposed. De-identification, if you don't need to have identities associated with data, don't keep that data in that way. And so a lot of those principles that the FTC has put forward, and frankly, that a lot of good privacy-focused organizations around the world have put forward, are being adopted by companies in the vacuum that's been created by the absence of comprehensive federal privacy legislation. And so the point is, if Apple and Google are imposing minimum standards on the apps that are in their app stores, I would like to take a little bit of credit for the FTC for the fact that they are doing that. The Federal Trade Commission has long urged companies to bear more of the responsibility to not rely solely on consent when we know consumers can't possibly read all of the disclosures that they receive. There have been studies done that calculate the hundreds of thousands of hours it would take for a consumer to read every privacy policy for every website and every service that he visits or uses. And it's a massive number of hours, hundreds of thousands of hours that it would take us. And so we know consumers aren't reading it. And part of the consequence of that is to say businesses need to be more accountable for risk assessment, risk management, having privacy policies in place, having vendor management principles in place, so that if you give information to a third party, like a researcher or a data broker, you are also asking them to be accountable for what they're doing with that data. And so maybe a bit of a long answer, but I view those guidelines that get imposed as very welcome in the marketplace.
I have a couple of questions from Anonymous about HIPAA, the Health Insurance Privacy Act. I don't know if, Matthew, you've come across that in your research on contact tracing policy. One says, my neighbor has COVID. I feel the government, the local government or someone should have informed me, but are they protected by the Constitution to keep that info private? Well, it's not the Constitution, it's HIPAA. And so we have, how does HIPAA factor into the contact tracing or privacy discussion? I mean, the Health and Human Services is charged with enforcing it, but how do other agencies also get involved?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have as comprehensive an answer as the questioner might ask. I've spoken offline with our health policy director, Michael Cannon, about HIPAA in other contexts. And I know we did, or at least we're planning to do an event on a book called Big Brother in the operating room or in the hospital. I forget the exact title. But it's certainly true that, look, there's a lot of sensitive information about people's health that is out and about there. But I don't want to claim to be a HIPAA expert, so I'd rather encourage anyone with questions about HIPAA in particular to follow the work of Michael Cannon and his colleagues, because it's something that he's certainly keeping an eye on.
And Ilya.
Yeah, I too am a simple constitutional lawyer, so don't know much about HIPAA.
I can talk a little bit about HIPAA, Ilya. So HIPAA protects information and. HIPAA protects information in the hands of medical providers, your doctor's office, your hospital, but it does not collect health information that's collected by, say, a Fitbit that you wear on your wrist or by health apps that you use on your phone. And frankly, that's one of the gaps because of emerging technologies that I mentioned for yet another rationale for federal privacy legislation. And so there is a lot of information, a lot of health information that is collected now by devices and is not covered by the protections that HIPAA offers because that data is collected and stored outside of providers' offices and hospitals and so on. And so the question is a good one, but I think it also reminds us there are exceptions for various reasons, both under HIPAA and under, for example, children's privacy laws, where for safety reasons, information may need to be disclosed. And so the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has long had the right to get information about people who test positive for various diseases like tuberculosis. And so in certain circumstances, we cannot expect privacy about, illnesses that we have or diseases that we're carrying because it is necessary to protect society. And so COVID positive names were reported to the CDC under various state laws and I think even a federal law. And so that is, it's something that we expect in this kind of circumstance, and maybe it fits into the special needs exception that you mentioned at the top of the hour, Ilya. So again, there are tensions, there are competing interests in privacy and the need for protecting the welfare of society. But HIPAA is an example of a place where we're seeing gaps emerge.
I had no idea that we had knowledge about HIPAA on this program. Fantastic. We have a question now from Facebook. Guinevere Liberty Nell. I don't know if Liberty is her actual middle name or a nom de guerre, but either way, terrific. And she asks, could anyone, private or public, be held responsible for not enforcing social distancing or other rules if people get COVID-19 by way of recklessness, whether by lawsuit or other means? Or are the only dangers being too harsh on liberties? I'll take a first stab at that by way of directing this question more to my colleague, Walter Olson, who was on our first Coronavirus in the Constitution series. And he's been writing about potential problems with being sued if you do, sued if you don't, if a restaurant or another business takes measures or doesn't take measures. The liability issues are pretty tricky, and that's why there's been a lot of debate in Congress, some question about whether Congress can change the rules for tort suits, after all, for the country, whether it can preempt state law, there's that word again, or whether this needs to be on a state-by-state basis. That does open up. If you went to a store and a week later you have COVID, what do you have to prove? Can you sue that store in the first place, even if the store ultimately wins? That's a lot of legal fees. What kind of precautions does the store have to take? And if it takes those precautions and you, the customer, or an employee still get sick, what does that mean? These are all very good questions, but it's with not many answers right now. We're kind of playing on an open playing field. But as I said, Walter Olson has written about this. Matthew or Christine, do you have anything on that?
I would only add that it strikes me as just very, very difficult to be able to show for sure that you definitely got ill from a particular person or a particular store. I mean, one of the difficult things about this virus is that you can have it for a while before exhibiting symptoms, and you can catch it from people who aren't exhibiting symptoms. So that strikes me as a potential difficult barrier. But I of course, defer to my colleague, Walter Olson, on anything to do with tort and liability.
All right. We have a question from Steve Dewey in Arlington, Virginia, right next door to where I am in Falls Church, Virginia. He asks, what kind of differences exist in state emergency decree laws? That is, do some states have no emergency decree laws? Some have laws for certain time periods, and have some state governors imposed emergency decrees that are both illegal and unconstitutional? I'll take that one. This is an issue of state law, and I don't claim to have expertise over any state's law, really. But each state has a different constitution, and states also, of course, have police powers. That is, the public officials in those states exercise certain powers that might not even be listed in the Constitution, unlike what is in the federal Constitution, which is a finite list of all the powers that the federal government has. Now, those state constitutions and related federal state statutes will have limitations or regulations about how those powers can be exercised, for how long, when the legislature has to get involved, if you're exercising emergency powers. Of course, we're in an unusual type of emergency. When you think about the typical emergency, whether a hurricane or a tornado, a natural disaster, whether a mass shooting, these things are short term. By definition, they end in hours or days. And so there's not much more of a question of these broader powers lasting indefinitely. Well, we're now, as I said, into the third month, and there have been disputes, including litigated in state courts, about legislatures trying to override or end or sunset certain powers, and courts ruling that certain powers indeed have sunset because there hasn't been legislative ratification. Others continue. And that's a very, I think, healthy debate to be had. Congress has passed, obviously, the PPP and other federal legislation. Certain states have done as well. So it's not that legislatures can't meet at all. It's not like they've been bombed and they literally do not exist. So state constitutions, state laws do impose certain kinds of restrictions. Of course, certain places, even if the legislature acts, the governor might veto that kind of restriction. And so you do have a tension, and in some cases, something that could be characterized as a state constitutional crisis. But that's a very good question in these times. Question for Commissioner Wilson. Can you give more details or examples of what companies employed contact tracing to track protesters in Minnesota, or if indeed they did so, or if this is an urban myth based on this exaggerated statement by a police commissioner?
So I do not have the details other than what has been reported publicly. The gentleman in Minnesota used the word contact tracing, and then I think tried to clarify what he said. But there are other examples reported or rumored on social media to be occurring. I don't know which specific contact tracing apps were deployed, but I think this example highlights at least two or three issues. First of all, digital trust. And it's one of the reasons that in the Washington Post survey that I mentioned, people are very worried about downloading these apps. Among other things, there's just a lack of trust in big tech and whether our privacy will be protected. Second of all, it shows that purpose limitations are important. We want limitations put on the uses to which data can be put once it's been collected from us. And so if I download a contact tracing app for purposes of, you know, the altruistic purpose of protecting society, I don't want to be a spreader of coronavirus unwittingly. And so, sure, I will let a company know that I have tested positive, and for altruistic purposes, others can be notified if they come in contact with me. But I certainly don't want my information, including my location information, to be used for a variety of other purposes. And third, I think it just highlights this connection between information that's collected for commercial purposes and information that ultimately gets used by the government. There is this inextricable link now because of the reasonable expectation of privacy test. And so we're talking not only about Fourth Amendment, but we're also talking about First Amendment, right to free speech, right to assemble, free exercise of religion. Lots of civil liberties issues have popped up because of coronavirus and because of the national protests that we're seeing and the uses to which our data are put.
We have a couple of related questions about actions by private businesses or companies. Can shops and restaurants require temperature checks or documentation of negative tests or contact information for later tracing? That is, you make a restaurant reservation, you give all your information that's stored in a log. Query whether the government then looks at that log at some point or not. Do workplaces have the right to require this from employees? And relatedly, what about immunity certificates to board and fly airplanes? What I'll just say about all of this is that if it's a rule put in by that private business, restaurant, shop, airline, well, they can put in pretty much whatever rules they want. And you can decide then whether you want to go into that store, restaurant, fly that airline. It gets a little different if it's a government, it becomes a government rule or regulation. But again, it's subject to that police power over which the challenges that we've discussed about, you know, for the last couple of months about restricting gatherings and closing businesses and shelter in place and all the rest. So if there's some justification for that kind of government regulation, then it could be allowed. Now, in terms of keeping people's information and having the government check that later, that runs into some problems with, for example, a Supreme Court decision in a case called Patel versus City of Los Angeles, where the court struck down just the requirement that innkeepers, motel owners, keep all these records that can be looked at by the police whenever they like without a warrant or anything else. Here, the justification would presumably be stronger for contact tracing. Maybe as long as the information is deleted or destroyed within 2 weeks, the incubation period of COVID or something like that, perhaps a regulation like that could be drawn if there are other privacy protections. Matthew or Christine, anything on that?
I would only add that it seems like it wouldn't necessarily be required to gather this kind of information from most kind of customers. So the majority of people who are still going to restaurants are going to make the reservation online. Even if they just show up, there's a very good chance they'll use a credit or debit card in order to pay. They'll be leaving digital footprints everywhere. So it's not clear to me that if a state were really, really intent on tracking down people who were, say, at a restaurant in a certain time period, that they would need some kind of special authorization or a new order or something like that. It seems to me that there's plenty of data already out there and mechanisms by which they could gather it. Now, absent some kind of special new law that just allows them to get it wholesale or a special need, there might be some hurdles that would frustrate law enforcement, but I don't think we should forget that there's already many ways for people to gather that kind of information.
Okay. Another question from, go ahead.
I was just going to say from an FTC perspective, there are principles again that would guide shopkeepers' activities here. So for example, data minimization, de-identification where possible, that sort of thing. And also I would commend to the person who asked that question, a very interesting read, again, Travis LeBlanc's letter to Acting Secretary Chad Wolf. Travis sits on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board, and he was addressing the airline's proposed collection of health information from passengers. And he pointed out that that information could be both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. There are many reasons that someone could be running a fever, including just being in a state of agitation or being pregnant, as opposed to having coronavirus. And then under-inclusive, because we know many people with COVID-19 can be asymptomatic. And so he asked a host of questions about how the program would be implemented and about how the data would be used and a variety of implications. And so I would commend to folks interested in this issue, I would commend that letter to you because he does grapple with a lot of these issues.
We have two related questions from Facebook. Cynthia Figueroa asks, it seems that never downloading the software is the only answer to avoid the contact tracing, which could impact the use of the phone. Is the only answer to get a flip phone? And then what if the federal government bans flip phones if they're being used to avoid tracking? A more technical related question to that from Guinevere Liberty Nell, the UK contact tracing app was supposed to be open source and was on GitHub, but the updates to it have not been. New versions were added to the Apple App Store, etc. How does this affect the legality if the same thing happens in the United States?
I'm happy to take a stab at that. I would say that look, Google and Apple are private companies, and if they mandate that some kind of contact tracing app is a necessary part of an update, it seems to me that there aren't that many difficult legal questions there. I'm not saying there are none necessarily, but that'd be much easier. Now, the government coming in and saying, look, to Google and Apple, you must impose or must have this app installed on your next update, that's a very, very different kind of question. It would seem to me that Ilya would know more than me, but I don't think the government would do very well if it tried to ban an entire kind of phone for this purpose. Now, it's certainly true that, look, if you are a Apple or Google user and you're not happy with these apps and you have privacy concerns, there are limited options if these companies decide to make the app download mandatory. And flip phones may be one way to do that. But certainly if it's a private company and they've decided this is in the best interest of their users, it strikes me as less legally troubling than the government coming in and mandating that private companies install certain technology.
And with respect to the privacy consequences of those apps, so we've already seen one instance in which a contact tracing app inadvertently disclosed information to third parties after guaranteeing that the information would not be disclosed to third parties. And so there's a lot of opportunity for mistakes here. In terms of FTC enforcement, right now, a lot of our privacy enforcement in this area is based on our ability to get at deceptive acts or practices. And so if an app promises in its privacy policy that information will be maintained in a certain way, it will be held secure, it will not be shared with third parties except under specifically identifiable circumstances, and then the information is shared in ways that controvert those promises, the FTC can go after the company for deceptive claims. We also have authority over unfair practices, although that's much more amorphous. And so I would say that right now, the FTC's authority with respect to enforcing any privacy issues for apps is too narrow. And again, federal privacy legislation could help us. But right now I can guarantee that if you download an app and it promises it will only use your information in a certain way, and it violates that promise, that's an area where the FTC can get involved for a deceptive act.
We only have a couple of minutes left. Here's one question that probably goes to Christine again, given that she displayed knowledge about HIPAA. Maybe she knows something about this might be ERISA. Anyway, Jay Haynes from Twitter asks, early in the pandemic, my employer purported to require all employees to inform them if the employee or anyone in their family were diagnosed with coronavirus. That seems to be a step too far. Do you know anything about that, Christine?
HIPAA, yes. ERISA, no. Sorry.
Good. Well, I can only surmise that normally disclosing health, this might be a HIPAA thing. Employment laws of various kinds, disclosing employees' health information to each other is probably normally a no-no, but might be allowed to prevent the spread of contagion or requiring employees to stay home. Those kinds of rules, I'm sure that would be backed up. But again, I'm not an expert on ERISA or whatever the more specific law in this area might be. Here's an interesting question. Again, going back to what Matthew was saying about the policy of contact testing, whether you do it digitally or the old-fashioned way, the problem with testing, aside from false positives, is that someone testing positive isn't necessarily contagious, and someone testing negative isn't immune from contagion. Doesn't this make contact tracing meaningless?
I think it certainly calls into question how feasible it's going to be to stop the spread. I mean, part of the worry throughout all of this is that we're going to take a sledgehammer to a nail, and that many people who shouldn't be are told to stay at home and to lock themselves down, and the impact that could have on the economy in the long run, and potentially even people's health, is something that we should all keep in mind. Unfortunately, look, that this virus is a tricky one. The asymptomatic is the length of time you can have it without going raises all different kinds of difficult issues. And this gets back to what I was saying earlier, which is as well as the legal issues, we should also make sure to keep in mind the feasibility issues and the utility issues.
Okay, and with that, I'm afraid we'll have to close. Thanks very much to everyone for attending. We're sorry we weren't able to get to all the questions. There were quite a number. If you'd like to follow up with any of us, our Twitter handles at least are on the event page, and you can contact me or any of my Cato colleagues through our website as well. The video recording of the event will be available on the webpage later today. And with that, thank you, everyone, and have a good weekend.